Surgeon in the Raw is the inspiring story of David Jackson, a life-saving military surgeon who worked in some of the world's most dangerous trouble spots. And that career was bookended with stints in the NHS. I'm delighted to welcome David to the show. Morning, David.
Good morning to you, Will.
Fascinating story. Let's start at the very beginning, as Mary Poppins once said. Let's talk about how you got into it, because, of course, becoming a surgeon is not a five-minute learning process, is it?
No, it certainly isn't. I mean, initially, as you know, I trained in medicine in Liverpool, and it was really my first entry into the operating theatre as a fourth-year medical student when I observed an operation which was an arterial bypass.
Right.
And I was fascinated, and I thought, well, could I do that? Would I be able to? I'm fairly practical, and I decided then and there that a career in surgery was what I wanted.
And do you have to have a kind of thought in your head of a specialty at that point, into what part of surgery you're going into, or do you have a kind of general surgeon role?
Well, that's a good question. In those days, really, most people who qualified in surgery were general surgeons as well as having a subspecialty. So in terms of what I wanted to do, I actually wanted to remain within general surgery and have a wide area of expertise. Everything I did was sort of towards that end, so
right.
I could handle most things if necessary.
I guess back in those days, and I don't know if it's changed, as a student in Liverpool and being a junior house officer, long hours and harsh criticisms, I imagine, were commonplace in your line of work.
Certainly were. It was not a place for, I would say, the people who could not take a joke or take criticism or couldn't really hack the job because of what was said to them and about them. And along the way, I think, as far as I'm concerned, it made me a better doctor and a better surgeon. You know, they didn't take prisoners. My consultants never took prisoners.
Yes,
but
yes.
On the other side of it, I did respect them for what they could do.
What, were they as fierce as the ones kind of portrayed in the Carry On movies, you know, with the stern matron wandering around and the consultants who were really grumpy all the time?
Yeah. You're quite right. It was sort of James Robertson Justice.
Yes, yes.
Consultant. Right.
Fantastic. And so, in your first stint in the NHS, were you then a general surgeon?
No, the first stint in the NHS was doing my junior surgical training.
Okay.
And then I decided, if you read the book, you know that I'd always had a hanker to join the army.
Yeah.
As that life, I think, suited me most. So I continued the rest of my training in the army and was trained in military surgery as well as as a general surgeon. And I also did a substantial amount of orthopaedic surgery.
Yes, yes.
To manage the fracture work mainly.
Yes, so that's an interesting distinction, isn't it? Being trained in military surgery. What are the distinctions in that world?
Well, I think the main distinction is dealing with, high-velocity injuries or penetrating
yes.
injuries,
yeah.
which can be much more serious than ever thought. You know, a hole that goes in the body and comes out the body can do an enormous amount of damage within on its track, which is not readily apparent. So military surgeons are trained to recognize and deal with these complications.
Mm.
We're also trained with how to deal with various areas of the body and, or in addition, trained to do what is appropriate for where you are in the casualty evacuation chain.
Interesting.
So, for example, if you're right at the front, like, you know, in Falklands, where I was, then you do sort of life and limb saving surgery and minor surgery when you have time. And then when the soldiers or injured servicemen get back to a field hospital or base hospital, then the more complicated stuff that can be done.
Tell us about the situation and the equipment that you were using when in the military. I'm thinking back to MASH, you know, the movie and the TV series where field hospitals were rugged, to say the least.
Yeah, well, you're quite right. They are. But there again, you have to be adaptable. You have to be able to make do with what you've got. And certainly wherever I was and whenever I did operate, apart from maybe one or two occasions, I always had the equipment I felt was adequate and robust and could do the job. The rest of things weren't necessarily particularly good because the fog, things get, equipment gets damaged or lost in the fog of war. And so once again, you have to be adaptable. I mean, at the end of the day, the most important thing is the injured serviceman.
Yeah.
And, you know, corners may have to be cut in order to deal with him.
Yes. And I imagine there's a distinct difference between being a surgeon working in an NHS hospital where maybe somebody's in for a scheduled operation that's not life-threatening, but I imagine yours was pretty much all the time life-threatening stuff, was it?
Yeah, that's absolutely true in a sense, simply because, you know, within the battle casualty spectrum, some are going to be very seriously injured and some are going to be minor injuries, and you can put them to one side, and therefore you have a way of assessing them, a priority system, so that, for example, someone who's got a, as I put it in the book, say a head injury with a sniper injury, and realistically should have no chance of survival, then he is essentially last on the list of treatment. He'd be a P3 casualty.
Yep.
Yet someone who was shot in the abdomen or in the chest and has extensive damage would be a P1. And so an experienced doctor under those circumstances would make some form of assessment while they're in resuscitation areas.
Your front line included places like Northern Ireland during the Troubles, Bosnia and the Falkland Islands. So you were put in some pretty dangerous locations.
Well, Northern Ireland wasn't so bad simply because it was within the hospital, Musgrave
right.
Park. The Falklands, where you got my experiences in the book about that, that was a little bit hair-raising with the bombing of the Galahad, but fortunately I was just off it. But if I said to you the most grueling, difficult tour was Bosnia.
Yeah.
That was very, very hard. Simply because even though we weren't providing surgical or medical assistance to the warring factions, it was a very difficult time in terms of being within a war, but not actually being at war.
Absolutely. And what about your hours when you're working in the military? Are they, you're basically on call whenever, or do you have a fairly regimented, if you pardon the pun, schedule?
No, the military says you work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year.
Wow.
So from my hours were as were necessary. So for example, in Falklands, in Northern Ireland and Bosnia, I was there 24/7.
Wow.
But in working in a military hospital, then there will be some sort of rota to get time off.
Right, understood. And then back you went to the NHS after leaving the army as a lieutenant colonel and settled in Aberystwyth as a consultant general surgeon. Why that move?
That move really was precipitated as within my personal story because a very, very difficult marriage and a very difficult divorce and a very public divorce with the red tops involved.
Ugh.
Really led to me, I should say, leaving the army under a distinct cloud when I felt that what had been said and what had been made public knowledge was a bit too much for me to carry on. And I had a real knock to my self-esteem and my confidence. And, of course, I didn't want the kids to get involved in what was a very, very difficult personal situation.
Yeah.
And so I felt my only option then was to leave the army, which I did not want to do. I left it under a cloud, which I certainly didn't want to do. And then with my new wife and amalgamated family, I think one, you know, the right word is escape to
yes.
Aberystwyth,
yes.
where I hoped relative anonymity and could kickstart my career again. And I would have to say that the job I took with the hospital and the people I worked with was the best antidote it could have been because I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Fantastic. You're very honest in the book, which is lovely to see, and you describe the deeply personal issues. I guess that was kind of cathartic for you, was it?
Yes, you're quite right. I never really came to terms with it over the years. As my wife Nikki said, you know, if you do this and you let it out, and I have really let out the minimum necessary, that is compatible with telling my story and my memoir. I didn't want to let my personal side and my ex-wife overshadow my story.
Mm.
But she was right. Once it all came out, and, you know, I've quoted Monica Lewinsky, I managed to take control of my life, take control of my narrative. I could say, well, actually, this is what happened. This is the truth, and I can live with it now.
You talk in the book that the move to sub-specialisation is forcing you, the general surgeon, into an increasingly difficult position. Can you maybe explain that to our listeners?
Yes, of course. On the whole, well, I was trained as a general surgeon, and there were very few areas of the body that I wouldn't, within that specialty, that I wouldn't venture into.
Right.
But as time went on and more consultants were required, then the training schemes, I would say, perhaps were shortened, and the degree of subspecialization was encouraged, in as much as you didn't become so much of a general surgeon, but you became, say, for example, a neurosurgeon, thoracic surgeon, yep. urologist, all yep. these subspecialties. And then over time, the numbers game came in. So that if you were doing a particular procedure, then you, unless you were doing a certain number of them, then you really should pass them on to someone who was doing a certain number of them. So gradually the general surgeon's remit got less and less. But fortunately, I took up the specialty of bowel cancer and bowel surgery in the last 10 years of my career. And was fairly successful at batting away a lot of the criticisms.
How interesting.
And then I decided that with the amalgamation that was being required to centralize a lot of cases within bigger hospitals, I felt, well, I'm a dinosaur. I'm not going to be able to cope with not being able to do the cases that I have been doing for years. And I thought, well, the time's come for me to go.
Let's talk about the dreaded COVID. You mentioned there you specialised in bowel cancer. We're told that many procedures have been put on the back burner or cancelled altogether because of the need to focus on COVID, as we're told. And many people will die from lack of treatment, many excess deaths that would never ordinarily have happened. What's your view on what's gone on in the NHS?
Well, but it would have to be a personal view.
Yes.
I think that there had to be a balance struck between the deaths that were preventable from COVID and deaths that were preventable from long treatment times and secondary therapy and long operating times and surgical interventions and all these things. A balance has to be struck. And I would agree that there are going to be some cases who perhaps have had their life shortened by the treatment intervals which were not appropriate or have been extended beyond what is reasonable. I think it is. I mean, I would say it's a very difficult balance to hold, and it depends on your priorities. But I'm sure, in fact, there are a few cases I read about where one could say, well, if treatment had been in time, maybe this wouldn't have happened.
And in terms of the individuals concerned, sometimes they would be scared to even come forward to say, you know, I've got symptoms of bowel cancer, I've got a heart issue, I won't go to the doctor because they're all too busy.
Well, you could say that. You know, that's absolutely true. And I think a lot of people would hide their symptoms on the basis that COVID was taking priority.
Yeah.
And also GP consultations are quite difficult apart from by the phone.
Yes.
And referrals to hospital are also difficult because of the COVID restrictions. So it has been a very difficult time.
Can I just ask you about bowel cancer and the current kind of state of play with it? Are enough people coming forward and being tested? And what would be a typical symptom that maybe one wouldn't spot?
Right. Well, the UK has had a bowel cancer screening program going for many years, which takes a stool sample and looks for hidden blood in it. And this is a good way of detecting abnormalities. And
yes.
then it will lead on to an endoscopic investigation. Put a telescope in and have a look around.
Right.
So on the whole, bowel cancer screening and the investigations that lead to it are very good, and I think they've lowered the screening age to 55 now.
Right.
So on the whole, that is excellent. Anybody who's listening in here and who's offered bowel cancer screening should certainly take it. It's a little bit messy and it's a little bit distasteful, but certainly it should be done.
And I'm assuming that as a surgeon, the quicker people come forward, the better your chance of doing something about it.
Yes. That's absolutely right.
Yeah.
Here again, though, you've got to strike a balance between people who have one would say alarm symptoms and the worried well.
Yes.
You know, which these illnesses do produce quite a significant amount of the worried well, so there has to be some way of determining which is which, and the screening program is extremely good at this. But on the other hand, anybody who has or may have something that suggests an alarm system, and I would say change of bowel habit, weight loss, blood in the stools, which one, or altered stools, and abdominal pain, should, and a family history of the disease, should certainly come forward and take their symptoms seriously.
Very good advice. Thank you for that. I was going a bit off piece there, but there we go. Surgeon in the Raw is the name of the book. David Jackson, been an absolute pleasure to talk to you today. You take care of yourself, and thank you for your time.
Well, thank you very much for the phone call.
Appreciate it. Take care. Bye-bye.